Good morning. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee for February 9th. This morning we have three bills before us, and we will be taking those up on our agenda. And okay, the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Szymanski.
Present.
Representative Mazzarol. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Allen. Representative Anderson.
Here.
Representative Champion. Representative Cornish. Representative Grunhagen.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Kreisel.
Here.
Representative Lane. Representative Lesh. Representative Liebling. Representative Shoemaker.
Here.
Representative Smith.
Here.
Representative Swazinski.
Here.
Representative Vogel.
Present.
Representative Wardlow.
The quorum is present. We have a motion to approve the minutes of the previous meeting.
Mr. Chairman, I move to approve the minutes.
Representative Anderson moves the minutes. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Okay, the first bill that we have up this morning is Senate File 1183. Representative Dill, chief author of the bill, could not be with us today. We do have Representative Tom Hackbarth here to present the bill. Representative Hackbarth, Representative Anderson, would you like to move Senate File 1183?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'll move Senate File 1183.
With the recommendation to pass?
With the recommendation to pass to the floor?
To the General Register.
To the General Register.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Anderson, for that. Members, this is a bill. Well, first of all, I should say that I think everybody here knows that hunting and fishing and outdoor recreation are a passion of mine at the legislature, and Representative Bill and I share that outdoor recreation and hunting and fishing and snowmobiling and ATVing and dirt biking and off-road truck driving and all of those kinds of things are things that we are very passionate about and have been ever since we've been in the legislature. And that's why I'm co-authoring this bill with Representative Dill. Representative Dill is ill and can't be with us today and will probably be out at least the rest of the week. So I'm here kind of pinch hitting for him. This is a bill that I'm going to let Mr. Franzen explain the bill and why we're here. But it's very, very important to snowmobilers and their events that they have, dirt bikers and events that they take part in. And we've been trying to get this done for quite some time. This is a bill that did pass the Senate. I don't think there were any no votes. I think it was 63 or 66 to nothing. And I think it's fairly non-controversial. But it's going to help snowmobilers and dirt bikers and ATVers put on some events. And it goes a little bit broader than that. But I'll let Representative Franzen or Mr. Franzen explain the bill. We also have some folks from Tom and Karen Umpress with the dirt biker that can speak to the issue if we need that. So if I could turn it over to Mr. Franzen.
Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. Mr. Franzen, please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Doug Franzen. I'm an attorney and lobbyist for the Minnesota United Snowmobilers Association. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Hackbarth not only for co-authoring and shepherding this bill today, but more importantly, from the promotion he just gave me. Lobbyist to legislator is quite a leap. This is a bill that should be familiar to many. You've seen this language before. You've passed this language before. The origins of this bill are in a coalition of recreational enthusiasts throughout the state. Representative Hackbarth mentioned some of them, but it's actually broader. Non-motorized recreational groups are included, rollerbladers, cross-country skiers, hikers, horse people. We all share the same problem. This bill addresses this. Quite simply, what the bill does is restores the $1 million municipal tort liability cap in a certain defined instance. And that instance is where a governmental unit is either contracting with a not-for-profit recreational group or issuing a permit to them. I'm most familiar with the snowmobiling experience, so I'll use that to illustrate how this works. Minnesota has roughly 25,000 miles of snowmobile trails. Of those, 2,000 miles, roughly 1,800 miles, are DNR trails, what we call state trails. And of those, 1,100 miles are contracted out to snowmobile clubs for grooming and maintenance. The remaining 20-plus thousand miles are developed and maintained through local volunteer groups in a contract with their local unit of government. They're reimbursed for grooming and other expenses through the DNR grant and aid program. One of the geniuses of Minnesota's outdoor recreation program is the policy of leveraging enthusiasts' volunteer hours. It would be impossible, for example, for the DNR to have the kind of trail system we have, but for these grant and aid partnerships with local units of government and local volunteer snowmobile groups. It's the same situation with a number of recreational users. When we contract with local units of government, we have to buy insurance to cover their exposure in the event of an incident. In any event, the local government's role is simply administrative, but nonetheless, there is potential liability there. We cover the insurance. Parenthetically, one thing as we move forward, in the last 30 years, my familiarity with this, there has never been a successful claim brought against a snowmobile club and a local unit of government on this. So the liability is a practical matter. The actual liability exposure historically is zero. The increase in the tort limits several years ago to $1.5 million necessitated snowmobile clubs and other recreational users to go out and seek higher insurance. What they found in the marketplace was that insurance was available in $1 million increments and $2 million increments. So a number of these local volunteer clubs were forced to buy twice as much insurance as they actually needed at a significant price. Being volunteer organizations, these increased insurance premiums posed a great hardship for them. For legislators dealing with the state budget, it's not much money. It might be $1,000 here for this club, $1,200 there for that club. But remember, these are small communities, small local volunteers holding bake sales, hot dog sales, that type of thing, to raise this money. Initially, when we brought the bill before this committee, there was some controversy and there was some opposition, most notably from the Minnesota Association of Justice. As we worked through the process, we resolved all of that controversy, and in fact, in the Senate, the Minnesota Association for Justice supported this bill. We worked through, we increased understanding. So this bill has been on the floor of both houses. It's successfully off the bill of off the floor of the Senate, as Representative Hackbarth mentioned, by unanimous vote. We and all recreational users who really keep Minnesota's outdoor recreational system viable would like and request very much that this committee pass this bill and move it to the floor. Policy reasons are simple. The law requires more insurance of us as a practical matter than any evidence would suggest is necessary. And simply by the nature of the groups that are the engine of this wonderful system, we can't afford that. It's a pretty straightforward bill, pretty straightforward language. It's been worked through. And again, we respectfully request that this committee again pass this bill as a separate bill. We do, as Representative Hackbar said, have some of these volunteer folks in the audience who, if the chair and the committee would like, can speak to their actual experience, as these are the people that actually do it. We have them. They're available to speak if you would like. If committee's time is such, I think they'd be very happy to forego testimony as well.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Franzen. Representative Johnson, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Franzen, I remember this bill from last year, and as I recall, one of the concerns was an unintended consequence where a larger nonprofit organization that was different than the type of community-based organizations you're referencing would, in fact, make sense to have a higher tort liability, perhaps. Was that the kind of issue that you have been addressing, or where's that issue at?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, yes, thank you for that. It's an excellent question. The question is, what we deal with is these are relatively small community organizations. What would happen if we had a very large event? Last year we used the Susan Coleman Breast Cancer Walk. I'm not going to use that one for a while now until things simmer down. But would the $1 million be adequate coverage for that exposure? And as we worked through this, we said, no, not really. But the point is, any local unit of government can require a higher level of insurance. In that case, or the state. The government can say, no, this is not something that $1 million is adequate insurance. We can require a $10 million or $100 million policy. We clarified in this bill, it became very clear that in the discretion of the local unit of government, which ultimately is being protected, and they can require as much insurance as they want in their discretion. So it is nimble, it is flexible, and it responds to those specific events.
Thank you, Mr. Franzen. All right. Seeing no other questions, is there anyone else here that would like to testify for or against Senate File 1183? Okay. Seeing none.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome, Mr. Franzen. Representative Hackbarth, any closing comments?
No, I think we've pretty much summed it up, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Representative Hackbarth. Representative Anderson, would you like to renew your motion?
I'd like to renew my motion that we're going to say Senate File 1183 be passed and sent on to the General Registry.
All right. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. We are passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Representative Hackbarth. The next bill on our agenda this morning is House File 1043. Representative Gauthier will be presenting the bill. We have a motion to bring the bill before us. Representative Johnson?
Yes, I'd like to move that this bill be passed and move to the General Registry.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Gauthier, good morning.
Welcome to our committee
and proceed with your bill introduction.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I have a couple of author's amendments to clean up the bill, if you would indulge me. The first one is A1, which deletes subdivision 3, the felony portion of the bill. And the reason for this is to rid ourselves of a fiscal note.
Okay. Representative Johnson, would you like to move the A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I've moved the A1 amendment, but the bill in the shape the author is requesting.
All right. Is there any discussion to the A1 amendment? All those in favor of the A1 amendment indicate by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, nay. The amendment is approved.
Mr. Chair, I also have a second amendment, A2, which cleans up some language, deletes of on line 14, and then puts the effective date of the statute.
And I'll move that amendment too, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Is there any discussion to the... Okay. Ms. Pirius, would you please read the amendment to us?
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment to 1043 would be page 1, line 14, delete of. In page 1, after line 20, insert effective date. This section is effective August 1st, 2012, and applies to crimes committed on or after that date.
All right. We have that amendment before us. Is there any discussion on that amendment? Hearing none, Representative, well, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. The oral amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill comes at the request of the Duluth Police Department. We have had a serious problem with car tampering, and I've asked Chief of Police Gordon Ramsey to give testimony this morning, so I'm going to turn it over to him.
Good morning, Chief Ramsey. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Gordon Ramsey is my name. I'm the Chief of Police in Duluth. I'm also the Vice President for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association and the Legislative Co-Chair. I'm here today to talk about vehicle prowls, otherwise known as vehicle burglaries. We've had an ongoing problem throughout the state. This just isn't a Duluth problem. It's a St. Paul problem. It's a Minneapolis problem, urban, suburban. Mankato has had recent issues with these. We have the biggest hurdle we face is that it's a misdemeanor currently to break into someone's car unless there's other factors to be included. We have had individuals do auto burglaries up to 40 times and face the same misdemeanor consequence. The problem is that the penalties are worth the risk. And this is probably the most common property crime of residences throughout the state. You know, and I've been hearing from people in Duluth and as well as other chiefs that we're hearing from the Do Somethings that something has to change. So when we go to a vehicle prowl or vehicle burglary call and the homeowner has apprehended the individual who broke into their car, unless there's an aggravating factor, it's a misdemeanor, which means the cops get there and they write a ticket for motor vehicle tampering, and the person's released. And the homeowners obviously are irate because they catch this person breaking into their car and doing whatever in there, stealing stuff, and they're simply given a ticket and released. They do not go to jail. I think that is that sums up one of the major reasons why we're looking at an increase in this in penalty for this crime. Thank you.
Are there any questions for the testifier, Representative Swidzinski?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ramsey, so if the issue is you're just going to move from times and not how much damage there was, you know, in total. I mean, oftentimes there's a, you know, a dollar value attributed to, you know, what the potential could be. Is there anything like that in the bill, or is it just how many times the occurrence has happened?
Chief Ramsey.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they currently there exists right now if there is aggravating factors such as damage over a certain dollar amount or theft over a certain dollar amount, that's chargeable. But it's frequent knowledge among the car burglars, you know, you got to watch your value and you got to watch how much damage you do.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Champion.
Thank you. Officer, can you give me an example of what would constitute tampers?
Chief Ramsey.
Mr. Chair, Representative, right now tampering with the motor vehicle is, you know, attempting to get into vehicles. You have to be able to articulate how they're attempting to get in, such as pulling on door handles, looking in through the windows, entering the vehicle, along those lines, getting inside the vehicle and rummaging through it are all fit the definition.
Okay. Representative Champion.
Thank you so much. So what you're saying from what I understand is that if a person is caught peering in a vehicle and could be caught doing that two or three times without causing any damage to a vehicle, that particular person could be guilty after a certain number of times of even a felony. Is that right, or am I reading this legislation right?
Chief Ramsey, Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Champion, we have deleted the felony portion of it. So it conceivably you could be dealing with a gross misdemeanor. But the intent is clearly the people who have entered into a vehicle and have been repeat offenders is to stiffen some of the penalty.
Representative Champion.
Representative Gauthier, thank you so much for that. So wouldn't it make, wouldn't it really get to your intent is if someone breaks in a vehicle as opposed to tampers with the vehicle? Because based on what I heard the officer say is that if I'm stopped or adjudicated guilty of just looking in a vehicle without ever causing any damage at all, then now I could be charged with a gross misdemeanor, which is up to a year in jail and or a $3,000 fine.
Chief Ramsey.
Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there needs to be something a little more articulable. It needs to be, pulling on the gas tank, pulling on the door handles, peering in, solely peering into a vehicle. You need more information than just someone looking inside of a car. And that this is existing language that's been around for decades.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Champion, I believe there is a case right on point that says that merely pulling on the door handle is not enough to be tampering. So it really is taking an additional step to get into the vehicle. You can't just pull up.
All right. Any other questions for our testifiers, or is anyone else in the audience today wishing to testify for or against this bill? Hearing none, Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 1043, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay.
Thank you.
We're passed. All right, the next bill on our calendar for today is House File 1535. Representative Cornish will be presenting the bill. And as soon as he is ready, we will proceed with his motion. Good morning, Representative Cornish. Would you like to move your bill?
Well, yes, I would. I'd like to move House File 1535 recommend it to pass and go to the General Register, and I do have an author's amendment whenever you would like that.
All right. Representative Cornish, would you introduce your author's amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, the author's amendment, I believe, is in your packet, numbered H1535A5, the A5 amendment. I'd like to move that amendment.
Great. Representative Cornish moves the A5 amendment. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do think that this does need some discussion, and I'd like, before we put this on, I would like to have the author explain what it does and explain the rationale for that, if we could.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Cornish, would you like to address the A5 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have my witness address that, Mr. Lee McGrath from the Institute for Justice, if that would be okay.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Good morning, Mr. McGrath. Would you please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lee McGrath. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Chapter of the Institute for Justice. The Institute for Justice is a conservative public interest law firm that is headquartered in Arlington, Virginia, and I run the Minnesota chapter of it. The amendment really just does two things, Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling. First, it changes the effective date from 2001 to 2002. I'm sorry, 2011 to 2012. You may recall that this bill passed this committee last year, but was not voted on by the floor, on the floor. The second thing that it does, it mirrors the bill that was passed by the Senate Judiciary Committee. In the Senate, there was some discussion about the languages of notice, what languages they would be in. And what this bill does is reflect the compromise that was reached by the author, Senator Thompson, Senator Harrington, Senator Latz, Senator Limmer, and Senator Ortman. And that is that the language be mandatory to be in English, but that local law enforcement would have the option of printing the notice to the property owner in additional languages. And so that local law enforcement could print it in Spanish, Somali, or any language that would be needed in the local community. And so those are the two changes that that this amendment does relative to what was passed last year by this committee.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. McGrath, for that explanation. You know, I think this is really a problem. I mean, I hope everybody's aware of what's going on here. I know some of you weren't here in the last term when we went around the block quite a few times about forfeiture. But what we're talking about when we're dealing with forfeiture is we're talking about the government taking people's property, okay? Taking away their property. Now, sometimes there are justifications for that. There are reasons for it. But this is an area where we want to be very careful that people's rights are protected, okay, and that they have due process, because this is a government swooping in. I mean, talk about big government, talk about government power against individuals. This is it. So just notice what's going on here in this amendment. Now, I know that the underlying bill just makes some tweaks. I think we should have much stronger protections for individuals in this state on forfeiture. I lost that battle in the last term, and I hope we'll bring it up again, because I think some of you, and I, in fact, Mr. McGrath, I work closely with him on this. And we happen to believe that the forfeiture laws should be much stronger. But what's going on here is we're weakening this sort of, you know, oh, it's a big compromise. Well, it shouldn't be a compromise on this, because basically what you're saying is we're not going to tell people in their own language, or now we don't have to tell people in their own language what we're going to do and what rights they have. So, you know, if you, I don't know, I guess I'd like to ask Mr. McGrath, if I may, if somebody, say, only speaks Spanish, and they're given a notice in English, and so they don't know what the procedure is, and they don't know what their rights are, and they don't exercise their rights because they didn't know, do you believe that that would violate their right to due process?
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, members of Representative Liebling, I think that there would be a potential challenge, a due process challenge, if the person was strictly a Spanish speaker, to use your hypothetical. I don't know the case law on such due process cases. I do know that that one of our coalition members has been the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and the County Attorneys Association is playing an important role that includes advising local law enforcement to print this in foreign languages. So it is the expectation, my expectation, as well as the County Attorneys Association, that this option will be fully exercised so as to avoid potential due process claims. So our anticipation is that this option to print in foreign languages will be exercised, will occur, to avoid those types of challenges, just the challenge, regardless of whether it will be successful or not, to avoid those challenges.
All right, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, in other words, Mr. McGrath, as I'm understanding you, you think it's okay because they'll do it anyway. But we're basically saying the state doesn't have to, that it doesn't have to be done, that it's going to be piecemeal. You know, it just seems to me, members, that this is a really ridiculous thing to do. You know, I'm fine with the dates and all that, but if we're going to, there doesn't seem to be even a practical reason to do this because, well, let me ask Mr. McGrath again. Mr. McGrath, are these forms printed now? Are they printed someplace centrally, or how is that going to all work? Is every department going to have to now print their own forms?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, these forms tend to be printed centrally, and the county's attorneys, Minnesota County Attorneys Association, does play an instrumental role in the printing. So it is my expectation, as well as my coalition member expectation, that we will achieve the complete notice, full notice, by wanting to avoid the type of challenges that you speak of.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm not going to, you know, continue to talk about this, but I'm going to oppose the author's amendment. Obviously, the dates need to be fixed, but I think this is going to be a big issue going forward, members, because it's unnecessary and it's really counterproductive to what we're trying to do here. It absolutely moves us in the wrong direction. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. McGrath, I'm going to ask you two or three questions, and I'd like a specific answer to them. I'm not going to ask the author, but I also believe that everyone in this state, everyone's civil rights should be protected, not just people that speak English. In the amendment, striking specific languages from the bill, you're adding, or the author is trying to add, the appropriate agency does not preclude them from printing in additional languages. I heard you testify that the appropriate agency would see what's necessary for the local community. Can you tell me specifically which appropriate agency, what agency is appropriate to make that decision?
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, this is the local law enforcement. It is the prosecuting agency that has responsibility for making this decision in coordination with local law enforcement.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Mr. McGrath, that's not specific enough. You refer to the prosecution community, the law enforcement community specifically. Who would it be? The police chief? The county prosecutor? Who would it be?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. McGrath.
Representative Smith, it would be the...
Mr. Chairman, final question.
Representative Smith.
How would this legislature know if the languages are being printed, if other languages are being printed or not?
Mr. McGrath.
So that we could review if we chose to do so.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, we have not put a mechanism in this bill for reporting of what languages are going to be printed. However, I believe it could be easily accomplished on an ad hoc basis if a legislator is interested in such information. I think it would because the printing will mostly be centralized you will see that more languages than less, and we could report back to the committee if that were necessary.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, Chairman, follow-up. You say it would not be difficult to include a reporting mechanism. In your opinion, would that not be a good idea?
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, the burdens on local law enforcement are many. I think this is a element of issues deep into how law enforcement deals with the local community. I submit that perhaps the sensitivity should be sufficient, the committee acknowledging that local law enforcement wants to avoid due process challenges based on notice, should give the committee comfort that it will take all necessary steps to avoid these types of challenges.
Representative Cornish, did you want to answer?
Mr. Chairman, just follow up on that testimony.
All right, Representative Smith.
Mr. McGrath, I think the providing of justice and public safety shouldn't be done just because one is afraid of a due process challenge. I think it's a proper role of government, and a primary role of government, to provide public safety and justice for everyone who's in this state. Thank you.
Representative Cornish.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair and members, whatever the apparent fixes or you'd like to see in this bill, over the last couple of years when we had the big gang strike force and the problems there and the 2725 work group and everybody got together, there wasn't a lot of resolution about how to fix the whole system. However, one of the things that was weeded out was this and the forfeiture, which was really a problem. Whatever the apparent minor tweaks or weaknesses of this is one heck of a lot better than what we have now. And the reason that I think the compromise was made and there's no reporting here is that there isn't now. And to institute some would cause a big fiscal note and a lot of costs at the local level for these law enforcement agencies to report. This is a lot more accountability than what we currently have. It's I believe it's a good bill. We could probably work on it another year and make a lot of other fixes. But this, I think, is a really good product that'll make some real changes, and it will give better justice. It could always be refined, I'm sure, but it is a compromise in the Senate between some fairly conservative and fairly liberal parties over there that came up with this compromise, and that's just what we want to mirror and put through.
All right. Thank you, Representative Cornish. On the A5 amendment, Representative Champion.
Thank you. This is for the testifier, Mr. McGrath. I'm looking at the proposed amendment, and I'm looking at line 1.3 that says page 3, line 33, if you'll look at that. It says delete the new language. And so the new language, from my understanding, would be Somali. And then it says, and strike Hmong and Spanish, which appears to be existing language. So my question to you is whether the notice of right to obtain judicial review of the forfeiture in these particular groups mean enough that it should be written in their language in order to make sure that they understand their rights. And secondly, can you also explain the rationale that was used in order to delete new language and existing language?
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Champion, I am very sympathetic to due process, and as is the County Attorneys Association and prosecutors. No prosecutor wants to have a fight on issues of notice and language. They want to get to the merits of any case. Regarding the history in the Senate as to how this came about because there were some concerns about adding foreign languages in statute, and Senator Limmer, to his credit, saw that in order to get this bill through the Senate, that a wise compromise would be to acknowledge that it should be printed in English and acknowledge the local control dynamic in play here, that local law enforcement and local prosecutors should have the authority and be free to print it in a language that meets the needs of people in their jurisdiction. That's the history, sir.
One follow-up.
Representative Champion.
Mr. McGrath, perhaps you can help me understand then, if you so eloquently articulate that what's important is to get to the merits of the case, and getting to the merits of the case requires someone to be given notice so they know what their rights are, so that they can get into the forum by which to have the issue heard. So how can you, or please help me understand how the merits of the case connects to the decision to delete information in the language of people who need to have it in order for them to understand what rights they have and what affirmative steps that they should take.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Champion, in order to get to the merits of the case, certainly notice is very important. The perspective that I was taking was to suggest that you have people of goodwill in the prosecutor's office who want to make sure notice is properly and fully given. And so local, giving them the authority to exercise that notice be given in foreign languages plays upon their goodwill to make sure that the prosecutor's office avoids due process challenges based on notice.
Mr. Chair, just one last comment, and then I'll be quiet. I would hope that the committee would also think very deeply about what is being proposed here. When you look at the amendment, it clearly articulates that we should delete new language as well as existing language. And if there was a real concern or a real, maybe the word is commitment to really making sure that all individuals understand their rights so that they can get to the merit of it, I have yet to understand or hear anything that would cause me to believe that that's the true spirit of it. Because to me, you have language, there's other folks who speak different languages, the existing statute already requires for it to be done, and I haven't heard anything that would suggest that it's cost or that it's ineffective or that it's whatever the fact of the matter is. And so I would ask the committee to think deeply about it.
Representative Cornish, reply to that.
I think, Mr. Chairman, the best way I could explain this is if you go into Best Buy right now and you buy a computer and you get a flip chart with about, I don't know how many different languages on it, and you move it around, and I think it's impossible to put every language into this form, and I imagine that there was a compromise struck between knowing which language is most prevalent in your area and not having to list all the others and leaving it up to the local authorities to know. And I can guarantee you we've got the attention of the local authorities and prosecutors for the last couple of years and all of the hoopla in the paper about all the rights violations that there was, and I think they've learned something, and I don't think they're going to put something out that is going to get them into trouble. So we can't regulate away all of the inequity of the law, but I think this has come for a big step here.
All right. Representative Johnson.
I have a question for the bill.
All right. All right. We'll pass on that question. Who is next? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to respond a little bit on the issue about reporting, because I think it was 2010 when we were dealing with all this. Maybe it was 2009, I'm not sure, but reporting on the whole forfeiture issue was tightened up quite a bit. And so now there is reporting, but there's never been reporting about this issue on whether things are given in the right languages, because it's never been an issue. The forms are printed centrally, and then no prosecutor has to worry about it. The form is the form. So now we're creating a problem here that doesn't exist, that didn't exist, and doesn't have to exist. So this is just, I believe, totally counterproductive. I also wanted to respond briefly to something that Representative Cornish said. This was to satisfy the liberals and the conservatives. I have to tell you, this is an issue that brings together people on both sides who care deeply about government intrusion into people's personal issues. I mean, if you care about government intrusion, you should be very concerned about forfeiture. And we had a big fight over this, and I have to tell you, I had a couple of amendments to make the law much stronger. They failed, but Representative Biskins voted with me. So this should give you an idea. This is something that I know many of you who are new this term don't, this is not high on your radar, but it should be. It should be. And Mr. McGrath and I worked very closely together. I'm not going to put him on the spot by asking him whether he agrees with what is being done here, because he's trying to represent the compromise. I know that. But I think that all of you, and I'm not going to make a motion right now to strike these parts, because I'm going to give you a chance to think about that for the floor. But if this comes to the floor, I will be bringing, if this language goes in, and my name is on this bill, if this language goes in, we will be dealing with this on the floor in terms of amendments, because this is really bad. And, you know, it sounds to me like somebody just doesn't want to have the, you know, language is named in law, and that's the issue. And that's silly. This is about people's fundamental rights to be informed before the government takes their property so that they can make use of the process. Because under our forfeiture laws, your car can be grabbed, your property can be grabbed, and then it's the burden is on you to go and say that was wrong. There's no burden. There's no justification for it. So this is pretty serious stuff, and here we're saying we don't have to tell people in a language they could understand. That's just wrong, members. So, you know, I'm not going to call for a roll call vote. I'm not going to make a motion to take this out, but I do want to alert you that this is going to come, and you should inform yourself about it.
All right. Thank you, Representative Liebling. We're having a little interference in the audio system here, and if you have a cell phone, if you could turn them off to eliminate the interference that we're getting in our audio system, please do so. Okay. Any further discussion on the A5 amendment? Sir, would you like to testify on this amendment?
Mr. Chairman,
please identify yourself.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. One of the many things that sometimes, as I've been at the legislature, I see amendments that I'm not aware of, or surprise amendments. This is not technically a surprise amendment because it's been on the web, I understand, but it was to me. And I look at the issues of due process, constitutional rights, a lot when I'm up here. I have my own opinions, but also for the public that may not know about these kinds of things. I just want to share with you at least a term of art that I'm seeing on page, on the amendment, on page 2, lines 34 and 35. This requirement does not preclude the appropriate agency. I've seen that word, or some kind of paraphrase of that word, over many decades here at the legislature, and that really means is it's up to the government whether or not they want to do it. And many times what that means is the government is not going to do it. I've fought for many years for people's rights, and there's that kind of language in there. And then what happens down the line, the legislature is going to have to come back and say, shall, will, whatever. You already have that shall, will, now do it. To go back without any kind of due diligence evidence, from my perspective, I think is not good for the legislative process and for the public. The second item is when the chairman or Representative Cornish indicated, Mr. Chairman, is we cannot regulate all the inequities. I agree. I mean, folks and myself and others have been trying to do that here, what we all see as the public or citizen. But I don't believe that we want to go back to create more inequities. And I contend that you will do that with leaving it up to government entities, whether or not they should or can, or will there be enough pressure, or will the public know about it to put enough pressure, or whether or not the defendant will be able to have enough money to do a due process challenge, or is the attorney smart enough to do it? I mean, I think it's very clear here, and I think we're just going backwards on the broadness for all of our citizens and public here in Minnesota. So I would encourage you to reinstate, you know, the Hmong and Somalia, or Somali, which is a new language, and Spanish, and do away with the sentence. This requirement does not preclude the appropriate agency. You get my point, and I'm direct in that regard. I want to thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Seeing no other questions on the A5 amendment, we will proceed to vote on the adoption of the A5 amendment. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay.
No.
The amendment is adopted. On to the bill, House File 1535. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I have no further statement. I'd just like to recommend that 1535 be passed and sent to the General Register.
Mr. McGrath, any further comments?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I urge the committee to support this legislation. My law firm is best known for representing Suzette Kilo, the woman whose home was taken by eminent domain. We took that case to the United States Supreme Court, where we lost. But the idea that government can take your property was so phenomenal that the public rejected the Kilo decision, and 44 states have changed their laws, including Minnesota, making eminent domain a more difficult to do. We look through the same lens when we look at asset forfeiture. There should be limits on the power of the government to take your property. This bill is an important step in that direction, to limiting the power of the government, ensuring that there is sufficient process, ensuring that there is good restraint on the power to take Minnesotans' property. I encourage the committee to adopt this. This is a property rights bill. This is a civil rights bill, and it is worthy of your consideration and support. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Representative Gilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, on line 12.4 of the bill. I'd like you to take a look at that language. I've spoken to a couple of other folks about it. Currently, under Minnesota statute, prosecutors can give folks stays of adjudication. And what that means is that, you know, in many counties, you admit that you committed the crime and you're placed on probation for that amount of time, but you're not given the felony conviction, or you're not given the gross misdemeanor conviction. And you've admitted to the facts, but the prosecutor, for some reason, either because the person is young, decides they're not actually going to do the conviction, they're going to do the stay of adjudication instead. Basically, what this says is that even if you have gone through the process and been put on probation and admitted to the facts, that you can only go through this process, or this hearing will happen after the adjudication of the criminal prosecution. And I'm not sure you intend to not allow the agency to forfeit property if the person has gone through the process and been put on probation but not actually been convicted of the crime. So if you could look at that language, I'm not going to offer an amendment. I really want you to think about if that's the intent. If you could just please take a look at that issue, because I'd like to know what you...
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilstrom, I see what you are saying, and it does make sense, and I will take a look at it, yes.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, can you remind me again exactly who are the stakeholders who are in agreement with the legislation that you're bringing forward?
Mr. Chair and
Representative Cornish.
Mr. McGrath knows the list of them.
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, this is a diverse coalition that includes the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. John Kingray was just sitting here a moment ago. He is the executive director. Additionally, it includes the Minnesota Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We have two representatives from that organization. We've worked, and it includes the American Civil Liberties Union. Carolyn Jackson is here, and my organization, the Institute for Justice. We have also had support from Mark Hassey, so it is a very wide coalition of people who are representing the prosecutors as well as the defense bar and civil rights organizations like the ACLU and my organization.
Great. A follow-up?
No.
Representative Johnson? All right. Is there anyone else in the audience today that would like to testify for or against House File 1535? Seeing none, we will proceed. Representative Cornish, would you like to renew your motion?
Yeah, if there's no more questions, I'd like to renew the motion of pass 1535, recommended to pass and move to the General Register.
All right, the motion is
as amended.
As amended. Thank you, Representative Cornish. All in favor of House File 1535 as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
The motion is passed. All right. Seeing no other items on our agenda today, our committee will meet again at the call of the chair. We can anticipate next week, Tuesday morning. With no further business, this committee is adjourned. Thank you.